Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Sue Udry, Executive Director of the group Defending Rights in Dissent, who discusses documents that reveal U.S. government surveillance of immigration rights activists, lawyers, and journalists on the U.S. southern border and in New York City. Sonia Meyerson-Knox of Jewish Voice for Peace, who takes a critical look at the condemnation of Representative Ilhan Omar for alleged anti-Semitic statements while calling out the hypocrisy of Donald Trump and Republicans for their use of racist, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic rhetoric. And Susan Burton, criminal justice reformer and founder of A New Way of Life, who talks about the residential program she's established for women returning from prison and the fight for incarcerated women. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Afghanistan has been hit hard by extreme weather in recent months. First, it was an intense drought that forced tens of thousands of villagers to flee their farms. Now, record flooding and snowfall have struck eight provinces, including Kandahar. United Nations humanitarian officials complain that European nations have not responded sufficiently to waves of hunger and human suffering in the war-ravaged nation. According to UN officials, 13 million Afghans were food insecure, and 3 million civilians were one step away from famine. A new appeal to international donors that called for over $600 million in humanitarian aid has been largely ignored by wealthy donor nations. Afghanistan has suffered the worst drought in recent years, resulting in the humanitarian crisis that has displaced 260,000 more people last year than the war between Afghan forces and the Taliban. The Norwegian Refugee Council reports that only a quarter of displaced Afghans have received aid supplies. The European Commission is providing an initial donation of 25 million euros to address the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan, but said it may give more, depending on future requirements. According to the Guardian newspaper, Afghans make up the largest group of asylum seekers traveling to Europe after those fleeing civil war in Syria. Women from the West African nation of Mali, who were victims of sexual violence, are pressing their case for justice and accountability before the International Criminal Court in The Hague. Yet, according to the Christian Science Monitor, the ICC, under growing criticism from African leaders, has never successfully prosecuted a single case of gender-based violence. Maria Mingo Jaramillo, a legal and program officer for Women's Initiatives for Gender Justice, an advocacy group based in The Hague, says this move sends a message to both victims and perpetrators that the ICC is willing and able to prosecute if national courts are not. That applies to both Mali and beyond. Women in Mali became victims of sexual violence as Islamist rebels took over large areas of Mali, including the ancient city of Timbuktu. They were required to wear veils and were prohibited from being seen in public with men other than their husbands. Women who did not comply were often subject to imprisonment, beatings, and rape. The case before the ICC is giving women hope that those who perpetrated gender-based violence will one day be held accountable for their crimes. The Nation magazine reports that investigators from the Department of Homeland Security were closely monitoring anti-Trump protests and activists in New York City during the summer of 2018. Documents obtained by The Nation via a Freedom of Information Act request show that Homeland Security investigations, the investigative arm of Immigration and Customs Enforcement, or ICE, transmitted detailed information about left liberal group protests to an undisclosed number of recipients, including at least one Department of Homeland Security supervisor. Among these was an email that contained a four-page document titled Anti-Trump Protest Spreadsheet 07-31-2018 that listed the time, date, location, and purpose of upcoming protests slated to take place around the city, including a Northern Manhattan rally against white supremacists organized by Congressman Adriano Espaillat that included groups such as Young Progressives of America, Refuse Fascism USA, and the New Sanctuary Coalition. Congressman Espaillat was outraged that his rally against Identity Europa, one of the extremist groups behind the neo-Nazi rally in Charlottesville, Virginia, was on the Homeland Security spreadsheet. He wants to know whether Homeland Security or ICE surveilled or infiltrated the peaceful rally and why white supremacists were not on the watch list. Attorney Carolyn DeSell, a staff attorney at Columbia University's Knight First Amendment Institute, says the spreadsheet amounts to government surveillance of peaceful protests and threatens to chill protected First Amendment activity. We'll have additional information on government surveillance of immigration activists on the southern border later in this week's show. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
Documents obtained by a San Diego TV news investigation revealed that the U.S. government created a secret database of activists, journalists, and attorneys. The individuals listed include 10 journalists, 7 of whom are U.S. citizens, a U.S. attorney, and 48 people from the U.S. and other countries labeled as organizers or instigators. In some cases, American border officials working with the Mexican government placed alerts on individual passports. Those listed on the database were linked to a migrant caravan of refugees seeking asylum in the U.S., who traveled through Mexico to the U.S. border last fall, around the time of the American midterm election. Journalists who were assigned to cover the caravan for news outlets, as well as immigration rights activists and attorneys who offered to assist caravan members, said they had encountered harassment and intense inspections by both U.S. and Mexican border officials. Customs and Border Protection responded to the revelations by saying the surveillance program was a necessary response to assaults against Border Patrol agents in November 2018 and January this year at the San Ysidro border crossing. Elsewhere, a Nation Magazine Freedom of Information Act request revealed another U.S. government surveillance database that monitored protests against Trump immigration policy and white supremacists in New York City, including one demonstration organized by New York Democratic Representative Adriano Espaillat. Your reporter spoke with Sue Udry, executive director of the group Defending Rights and Dissent, who examines the chilling effect government surveillance has on activists, journalists, and lawyers' protected First Amendment right to free speech.
The database was leaked to the NBC affiliate in San Diego, but we knew about the impacts of this database before we knew that there was hard evidence that there was a blacklist of people on the border. What's wonderful about this leak is that it's a document that substantiates that there was a program targeting specifically activists and journalists and lawyers, and something called instigators in the documents. We knew it was happening, but now the plausible deniability is taken away because we see this list of 59 people, the bulk of whom are U.S. citizens, on this list that has stamped on the front. You can see on the document that it's an intelligence product of the Mexican and U.S. government working together.
Sue, can you give us some examples of what these individuals who are on this list experienced at the border?
It's a range of things. There were some people who, for example, a photojournalist who's a U.S. citizen who just kept being stopped at the border and then finally was denied entry into Mexico. A lawyer who kept getting shuttled into the secondary screening, which meant hours and hours of waiting to be able to cross the border. And then there's one activist who was interviewed by, I think, The Intercept. He said that he's a U.S. citizen living in Mexico, and he was supposed to go up to San Diego for a meeting of activist advocates who are working on U.S. policy, but he didn't go because he was just so frightened about what was going to happen at the border. Was he going to get shunted into secondary screening and have to, you know, wait for 8 hours? Some people were actually apparently deported from Mexico. So it's a range of things that were happening to these people who ended up on this list, whose passports were marked, and so who were subject to this more intense interrogation at the border.
Sue Udry, what is it your organization and other groups working to protect journalists and activists doing to push back on this collection of information about folks who are practicing their journalism or are activists when it comes to immigration policy? How can this be addressed? Through the courts, through the House of Representatives, now under control of the opposition party, the Democrats, what can be done?
I think that what needs to happen is systemic change, and it starts with, you know, Congress has all too happily handed over so many authorities to the executive branch, you know, just up and down the line from war powers to just very lenient guidelines and rules for federal law enforcement agencies, from the FBI to Customs and Border Protection. An argument could be made that what CBP did is not necessarily against any of the rules guiding them, and that's the problem, is that Congress needs to really instill some very strict rules that they've just not bothered to do. I would say that during the Bush administration, it was because there was still this heavy fear of 9/11 and not wanting that to happen again. And then under Obama, when the Democrats were in power, it was like, oh, Obama, he's fine. We don't need to worry about just the vast authorities that we've given to law enforcement and intelligence agencies. And now that Trump is in office, it's dawning on people that, oh, yeah, we really left the door wide open, and now we've got to address it. So I was pleased to see that in the House and the Senate, there have been strong letters written to ICE and DHS about this, and that I think there will be hearings and there will be some more congressional oversight about what's going on. And so that's very good. It's great that this document came to light. So it gives Congress, it kind of shoves them into the realization that they've got to take some bold action.
That was Sue Udry, executive director of the group Defending Rights in Dissent. Find more analysis and commentary on U.S. government surveillance of immigration rights activists, lawyers, and journalists by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. After newly elected Muslim member of Congress, Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat of Minnesota, tweeted that American political leaders' support for Israel is all about the Benjamins on February 10th, she was attacked for what her detractors charge was anti-Semitism. During a subsequent talk and Q&A session at a Washington, D.C. bookstore, where she apologized for the remark, Omar asked why it's okay for people to push for allegiance to a foreign country and not talk about a powerful lobby that is influencing policy, a reference to the lobby group, American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, or AIPAC. That set off a new round of accusations from Republicans and fellow Democrats that Omar was repeating anti-Semitic tropes about Jews not being loyal to their nations. Again, the Congresswoman apologized, saying she had not intended her words to be interpreted the way many had heard them. A resolution was raised by the Democratic leadership in the House, initially to condemn anti-Semitism without singling out Omar, but then the language was broadened out to condemn all hateful expressions of intolerance. The measure passed overwhelmingly, with only 23 Republicans opposing it. Many progressives have come to the defense of Omar, arguing that it's fair to point out the influence of AIPAC and charge that the attacks are part of a broader campaign to smear a young Muslim congresswoman and suppress all criticism of Israel. Your reporter spoke with Sonia Meyerson-Knox, media program manager with the group Jewish Voice for Peace. Here she shares her views on the criticism of Representative Omar, while pointing out the hypocrisy of many Republicans and their president, Donald Trump, who regularly engage in hateful, racist, Islamophobic, and anti-Semitic rhetoric.
Ilhan Omar has now twice been accused very publicly and with quite a lot of attention, including from Democratic Party leadership, of employing anti-Semitic tropes. And I think it's very important to actually look at what she said and what she tweeted. So the first time she tweeted a response to a tweet that Glenn Greenwald, the journalist from The Intercept, had put out, looking at the first bill that this current Senate passed, which would make the boycott, sanctions, and divestment movement for Palestinian human rights, criminalize it, make it illegal in one way or another. And Ilhan Omar basically responded to that tweet by jokingly pulling a line from a Puff Daddy rap song saying, you know, it's all about the Benjamins. And when asked directly what that was referring to, she said AIPAC, meaning basically that she was implying that AIPAC, which is a very large and very successful lobby and which prides itself on being able to influence congressional politics such that there is a staunch support for Israel and increasingly not just for Israel, but for the Likud party, which is Benjamin Netanyahu, the current prime minister, his party in particular. That's what they pride themselves on doing, and they are not shy about that. None of that is anti-Semitic. Implying that Jewish people are using Jewish monies to specifically buy elections in corrupt, insidious, and backhanded secret ways, that is a longstanding anti-Semitic trope. But Ilhan Omar didn't refer to that trope. She didn't talk about Jews at all. She talked about AIPAC and its influence in terms of making America support Israel, which she criticizes based on its treatment for Palestinian human rights. There's nothing anti-Semitic there at all. And then after the fury and the furor that developed from that, she then offered an incredibly heartfelt and I thought nuanced, detailed apology. And then continuing to speak about that experience a week or so later, 2 weeks later, she pointed out, talking about herself, as a member of Congress, she was expected to have a dual loyalty, meaning that she was expected to not criticize the state of Israel. And again, that is not in any way anti-Semitic. Members of Congress are all the time expected to not criticize the United States and Israel's quote-unquote special relationship, which is a continued amount of support for the state of Israel. There are anti-Semitic tropes that go way back that accuse Jews of not being able to be trustworthy because they would have a secondary loyalty or a loyalty that supersedes to the state of Israel, such as Catholics often for a long time faced, and maybe still do face, racism and prejudice, that they couldn't be loyal to America because they would hold the Pope in the first highest authority. That's anti-Semitism or that's racism, and that's unacceptable. But Ilhan Omar didn't talk about Jews having dual loyalty. She talked about herself and members of Congress being expected to have dual loyalty. And in fact, when you look at who the most ardent supporters of Israel are right now, Michael Huckabee and Sarah Palin and whatnot, we're looking at Christian evangelical politicians. So increasingly, the idea that only Jews support Israel is obviously incorrect, as is the idea that all Jews support Israel is increasingly incorrect. And furthermore, therefore, criticizing Israel then cannot be anti-Semitic.
Sonia, I did want to ask you about the hypocrisy of some members of Congress, particularly Republicans, who have been cited over and over again for comments or tweets or campaign rhetoric that many have interpreted to be anti-Semitic, with very little focus from the media or other members of Congress being critical of those comments.
It's an incredible hypocrisy, and it absolutely reinforces the point that much of the criticism that Congresswoman Omar has been exposed to is based entirely upon the fact that she is Muslim and wears a hijab, and she's also black. She's Somali. So we have racism, we have Islamophobia, we have, I think, also sexism and the general fear of a new rising powerful generation of politicians coming together. Meanwhile, we have the former House Minority Leader Ken McCarthy tweeted out about 7 months ago or so accusing three different Jewish Democratic donors of buying the election, certain election results. Representative Jim Jordan more recently referred to a wealthy donor by name in a tweet and replaced the S in that donor's name with a dollar sign. These are absolutely anti-Semitic dog whistles. But we have even more explicit examples than that. We also have Trump himself engaging in quite a lot of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic tropes. He brought Sebastian Gorka and Steve Bannon onto his administration at various points. He retweeted incredibly anti-Semitic tropes about George Soros that have been circulating now for a number of years that really do employ all of the anti-Semitic stereotypes that we're used to seeing. George Soros' caricature was disfigured so that he had a hook nose and he had big eyebrows and he was clutching bags of money. I mean, this is unacceptable behavior. And it's targeting a person, an individual, George Soros himself. And Trump retweeted that. When neo-Nazis carried tiki torches through Charlottesville and chanted, "Jews will not replace us," we were told by the president that some very fine people were there, and that behavior was not in any way criticized or condemned. So we are seeing anti-Semitism at the highest reaches of the United States government, and then we see it, of course, finally manifest in, you know, the killing of 11 Jewish people in the Tree of Life Synagogue in Pittsburgh. And yet these are the people, and this is the party that demands that everybody else that criticizes Israel is automatically anti-Semitic. It's absolutely absurd and reprehensible and speaks to nothing more than the extent to which what we're seeing now with Ilhan Omar is really all about Islamophobia, racism, and the attempt to silence any criticism of Israel.
That was Sonia Meyerson-Knox, media program manager with the group Jewish Voice for Peace. Find more perspectives on the controversy surrounding Representative Omar's comments on Israel by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In celebration of International Women's Day on March 8th, a woman spoke to a large crowd in New Haven, Connecticut, about women who are usually not celebrated at all, those who are incarcerated and struggling to recover from drug and alcohol addiction. Susan Burton, like a great many incarcerated women, grew up poor, suffered sexual abuse as a child, was raped as a teen, bore a daughter, and then lost all hope when another child, a 5-year-old son, was run over accidentally, killed by police. After spiraling into addiction and being incarcerated 6 times, she finally found a recovery program that worked for her and successfully completed it more than 20 years ago. Burton then began establishing homes for other women coming home from prison with a range of support services. She now has 7 such homes in the Los Angeles area. Burton's program is called A New Way of Life, and her new memoir is titled Becoming Ms. Burton, From Prison to Recovery to Leading the Fight for Incarcerated Women. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended and recorded her talk at Gateway Community College, which was sponsored by the Connecticut Women's Consortium. Here, Burton begins by talking about the struggles in her early life.
I was, you know, learning how to get through with the least harm as possible and negotiating one trauma for the next, you know, what was going to be more bearable. And that's the story of many, many, many of the women. I'll say 80% of the women that come through A New Way of Life, you know, we talk about and work through and try to understand what happened early on that affects the way we are responding today. That's the story of women all over this country who have responded to their treatment, their environment, in ways that this country finds unacceptable and locks them up. And locks them up and spends hundreds of thousands of dollars each year to incarcerate them and then spend them back out into our community more harmed than when they went in.
Burton eventually got into a 100-day residential treatment center.
And what I discovered, you know, it was a upscale community. It was Santa Monica. It was by the beach. There was so much there. But what I found for me, for the first time in my life, I felt safe. And there was compassion there. There was empathy there. There was food there. There was clothing there. There was regularity, and I got introduced to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. But the other thing that I discovered there is that people in Santa Monica didn't go to prison for drugs. What is this? They get a court card. They get deferred to treatment. They get, you know, community service. And all of those times, six times, I was sentenced to prison for possession of drugs. And I'm thinking, nobody felt that they could invest in me. I wasn't worth an investment. You know, what's wrong, you know, with the society? And I began to heal, and I began to get stronger. I eventually went back to school. But I began to think about how hard my life had been and how it could have and it should have been different had anyone thought enough to just make a simple investment. You know, I can remember walking in the courtroom and telling the judge about my son and what had happened and that I needed help. And that judge sentenced me to prison. And I was stripped of everything, my identity, my individuality, my dignity, my purpose, any dreams, any hope. It was just gone. But in Santa Monica, it was altogether different. And so I saved a few dollars, went to work as a caregiver, and bought a little house. And I would go down to the bus station in Skid Row, downtown L.A., where women get off, where we get off the bus and try to make a life. And I'd meet my friends, and I'd offer them a bed, a safe place, and that started a New Way of Life Reentry Project. To date, more than 1,000 women have been through those homes. There's 7 homes. You know, we have all types of services and legal services. We have a legal department, organizing department, leadership department.
After her book came out, world-renowned architect Frank Gehry invited her to do a project on the architecture of prisons.
And I got to go to Finland, and I got to go to Norway, and I got to go to Lisbon, and I got to see what other countries do. And what I came back with is that this country is intentionally barbaric. And yes, they're intentionally, from the way they structure the prison, the whole thing is made to harm people, and it's intentional, and that we as a nation has this deep-seated need for revenge.
That was Susan Burton, criminal justice reformer and founder of A New Way of Life, speaking in New Haven, Connecticut, at an International Women's Day event on March 8th. Learn more about Burton's residential program for women returning from prison by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WESU in Middletown, Connecticut, WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KOWA in Olympia, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgardner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.